earns much more than small ones. Anchoring and the two systems. The effects of random anchors have much to tell us about the relationship between System 1 and System 2. Anchoring effects have always been studied in tasks of judgment and choice that are ultimately completed by System 2. However, System 2 works on data that is retrieved from memory in an automatic and involuntary operation of System 1. System 2 is therefore susceptible to the biasing influence of anchors that make some information easier to retrieve. Furthermore, System 2 has no control over the effect and no knowledge of it. The participants who have been exposed to random or absurd anchors, such as Gandhi's death at age 144, confidently deny that this obviously useless information could have influenced their estimate. And they are wrong. We saw in the discussion of the law of small numbers that a message, unless it is immediately rejected as a lie, will have the same effect on the associative system regardless of its reliability. The gist of the message is the story, which is based on whatever information is available, even if the quantity of the information is slight and its quality is poor. What you see is all there is. When you read a story about the heroic rescue of a wounded mountain climber, its effect on your associative memory is much the same if it is a news report or the synopsis of a film. Anchoring results from this associative activation. Whether the story is true or believable matters little, if at all. The powerful effect of random anchors is an extreme case of this phenomenon because a random anchor obviously provides no information at all. Earlier, I discussed the bewildering variety of priming effects, in which your thoughts and behavior may be influenced by stimuli to which you pay no attention at all, and even by stimuli of which you are completely unaware. The main moral of priming research is that our thoughts and our behavior are influenced much more than we know or want by the environment of the moment. Many people find the priming results unbelievable because they do not correspond to subjective experience. Many others find the results upsetting because they threaten the subjective sense of agency and autonomy. If the content of a screensaver on an irrelevant computer can affect your willingness to help strangers without your being aware of it, how free are you? Anchoring effects are threatening in a similar way. You are always aware of the anchor and even pay attention to it, but you do not know how it guides and constrains your thinking because you cannot imagine how you would have thought if the anchor had been different or absent. However, you should assume that any number that is on the table has had an anchoring effect on you, and if the stakes are high, you should mobilize yourself, your system too, to combat the effect. Speaking of anchors, the firm we want to acquire sent us their business plan with the revenue they expect. We shouldn't let that number influence our thinking. Set it aside. Plans are best-case scenarios. Let's avoid anchoring on plans when we forecast actual outcomes. Thinking about ways the plan could go wrong is one way to do it. Our aim in the negotiation is to get them anchored on this number. Let's make it clear that if that is their proposal, the negotiations are over. We do not want to start there. The defendant's lawyers put in a frivolous reference in which they mentioned a ridiculously low amount of damages, and they got the judge anchored on it. Chapter 12. The Science of Availability. Amos and I had our most productive year in 1971-72, which we spent in Eugene, Oregon. We were the guests of the Oregon Research Institute, which housed several future stars of all fields in which we worked: judgment, decision-making, and intuitive prediction. Our main host was Paul Slovic, who had been Amos's classmate at Ann Arbor and remained a lifelong friend. Paul was on his way to becoming the leading psychologist among scholars of risk, a position he had held for decades, collecting many honors along the way. Paul and his wife, Roz, introduced us to life in Eugene, and soon we were doing what people in Eugene do: jogging, barbecuing, and taking children to basketball games. We also worked very hard, running dozens of experiments and writing our articles on judgment heuristics. At night, I wrote Attention and Effort. It was a busy year. One of our projects was the study of what we called the availability heuristic. We thought of that heuristic when we asked ourselves what people actually do when they wish to estimate the frequency of a category, such as people who divorce after the age of 60, or dangerous plants. The answer was straightforward. Instances of the class will be retrieved from memory, and if retrieval is easy and fluent, the category will be judged to be large. We defined the availability heuristic as the process of judging frequency by the ease with which instances come to mind. The statement seemed clear when we formulated it, but the concept of availability has been refined since then. The two-system approach had not yet been developed when we studied availability, and we did not attempt to determine whether this heuristic is a deliberate problem-solving strategy or an automatic operation. We now know that both systems are involved. A question we considered early was how many instances must be retrieved to get an impression of the ease with which they come to mind. We now know the answer: none. For example, think of the number of words that can be constructed from the two sets of letters here: XUZONLCJM, TAPCERHOB. You knew almost immediately, without generating any instances, that one set offers far more possibilities than the other, probably by a factor of 10 or more. Similarly, you do not need to retrieve specific news stories to have a good idea of the relative frequency with which different countries have appeared in the news during the past year. Belgium, China, France, Congo, Nicaragua, Romania. The availability heuristic, like other heuristics of judgment, substitutes one question for another. You wish to estimate the size of a category or the frequency of an event, but you report an impression of the ease with which instances come to mind. Substitution of questions inevitably produces systematic errors. You can discover how the heuristic leads to biases by following a simple procedure: list factors other than frequency that make it easy to come up with instances. Each factor in your list will be a potential source of bias. Here are some examples. A salient event that attracts your attention will be easily retrieved from memory. Divorces among Hollywood celebrities and sex scandals among politicians attract much attention, and instances will come easily to mind. You are therefore likely to exaggerate the frequency of both Hollywood divorces and political sex scandals. A dramatic event temporarily increases the availability of its category. A plane crash that attracts media coverage will temporarily alter your feelings about the safety of flying. Accidents are on your mind for a while after you see a car burning at the side of the road, and the world is for a while a more dangerous place. Personal experiences, pictures, and vivid examples are more available than incidents that happened to others, or mere words, or statistics. A judicial error that affects you will undermine your faith in the justice system more than a similar incident you read about in a newspaper. Resisting this large collection of potential availability biases is possible, but tiresome. You must make the effort to reconsider your impressions and intuitions by asking such questions as, is our belief that thefts by teenagers are a major problem due to a few recent instances in our neighborhood? Or, could it be that I feel no need to get a flu shot because none of my acquaintances got the flu last year? Maintaining one's vigilance against biases is a chore, but the chance to avoid a costly mistake is sometimes worth the effort. One of the best-known studies of availability suggests that awareness of your own biases can contribute to peace in marriages and probably in other joint projects. In a famous study, spouses were asked, how large was your personal contribution to keeping the place tidy, in percentages? They also answered similar questions about taking out the garbage, initiating social engagements, etc. Would the self-estimated contributions add up to 100%, or more or less? As expected, the self-assessed contributions added up to more than 100%. The explanation is a simple availability bias. Both spouses remember their own individual efforts and contributions much more clearly than those of the other, and the difference in availability leads to a difference in judged frequency. The bias is not necessarily self-serving. Spouses also overestimated their contribution to causing quarrels, although to a smaller extent than their contributions to more desirable outcomes. The same bias contributes to the common observation that many members of a collaborative team feel they have done more than their share and also feel that the others are not adequately grateful for their individual contributions. I am generally not optimistic about the potential for personal control of biases, but this is an exception. The opportunity for successful debiasing exists because the circumstances in which issues of credit allocation come up are easy to identify, the more so because tensions often arise when several people at once feel that their efforts are not adequately recognized. The mere observation that there is usually more than 100% credit to go around is sometimes sufficient to diffuse the situation. In any event, it is a good thing for every individual to remember. You will occasionally do more than your share, but it is useful to know that you are likely to have that feeling even when each member of the team feels the same way. The psychology of availability. A major advance in the understanding of the availability heuristic occurred in the early 1990s when a group of German psychologists led by Norbert Schwartz raised an intriguing question. How will people's impressions of the frequency of a category be affected by a requirement to list a specified number of instances? Imagine yourself a subject in that experiment. First, list 6 instances in which you behaved assertively. Next, evaluate how assertive you are. Imagine that you had been asked for 12 instances of assertive behavior, a number most people find difficult. Would your view of your own assertiveness be different? Schwartz and his colleagues observed that the task of listing instances may enhance the judgments of the trait by 2 different routes. The number of instances retrieved, the ease with which they come to mind. The request to list 12 instances pits the 2 determinants against each other. On the one hand, you have just retrieved an impressive number of cases in which you were assertive. On the other hand, while the first 3 or 4 instances of your own assertiveness probably came easily to you, you almost certainly struggled to come up with the last few to complete a set of 12. fluency was low. Which will count more, the amount retrieved or the ease and fluency of the retrieval? The contest yielded a clear-cut winner. People who had just listed 12 instances rated themselves as less assertive than people who had listed only 6. Furthermore, participants who had been asked to list 12 cases in which they had not behaved assertively ended up thinking of themselves as quite assertive. If you cannot easily come up with instances of meek behavior, you are likely to conclude that you are not meek at all. Self-ratings were dominated by the ease with which examples had come to mind. The experience of fluent retrieval of instances trumped the number retrieved. An even more direct demonstration of the role of fluency was offered by other psychologists in the same group. All the participants in their experiment listed 6 instances of assertive or non-assertive behavior while maintaining a specified facial expression. Smilers were instructed to contract the zygomaticus muscle, which produces a light smile. Frowners were required to furrow their brow. As you already know, frowning normally accompanies cognitive strain, and the effect is symmetric. When people are instructed to frown while doing a task, they actually try harder and experience greater cognitive strain. The researchers anticipated that the frowners would have more difficulty retrieving examples of assertive behavior and would therefore rate themselves as relatively lacking in assertiveness. And so it was. Psychologists enjoyed experiments that yield paradoxical results, and they have applied Schwartz's discovery with gusto. For example, people believe that they use their bicycles less often after recalling many rather than few instances, are less confident in a choice when they are asked to produce more arguments to support it, are less confident that an event was avoidable after listing more ways it could have been avoided, are less impressed by a car after listing many of its advantages. A professor at UCLA found an ingenious way to exploit the availability bias. He asked different groups of students to list ways to improve the course, and he varied the required number of improvements. As expected, the students who listed more ways to improve the class rated it higher. Perhaps the most interesting finding of this paradoxical research is that the paradox is not always found. People sometimes go by content rather than by ease of retrieval. The proof that you truly understand a pattern of behavior is that you know how to reverse it. Schwartz and his colleagues took on this challenge of discovering the conditions under which this reversal would take place. The ease with which instances of assertiveness come to the subject's mind changes during the task. The first few instances are easy, but retrieval soon becomes much harder. Of course, the subject also expects fluency to drop gradually, but the drop of fluency between 6 and 12 instances appears to be steeper than the participant expected. The results suggest that the participants make an inference. If I am having so much more trouble than expected coming up with instances of my assertiveness, then I can't be very assertive. Note that this inference rests on a surprise, fluency being worse than expected. The availability heuristic that the subjects apply is better described as an unexplained unavailability heuristic. Schwartz and his colleagues reasoned that they could disrupt the heuristic by providing the subjects with an explanation for the fluency of retrieval that they experienced. They told the participants they would hear background music while recalling instances and that the music would affect performance in the memory task. Some subjects were told that the music would help. Others were told to expect diminished fluency. As predicted, Participants whose experience of fluency was explained did not use it as a heuristic. The subjects who were told that music would make retrieval more difficult rated themselves as equally assertive when they retrieved 12 instances as when they retrieved 6. Other cover stories have been used with the same result. Judgments are no longer influenced by ease of retrieval when the experience of fluency is given a spurious explanation by the presence of curves or straight text boxes, by the background color of the screen, or by other irrelevant factors that the experimenters dreamed up. As I have described it, the process that leads to judgment by availability appears to involve a complex chain of reasoning. The subjects have an experience of diminishing fluency as they produce instances. They evidently have expectations about the rate at which fluency decreases, and those expectations are wrong. The difficulty of coming up with new instances increases more rapidly than they expect. It is the unexpectedly low fluency that causes people who were asked for 12 instances to describe themselves as unassertive. When the surprise is eliminated, low fluency no longer influences the judgment. The process appears to consist of a sophisticated set of inferences. Is the automatic system one capable of it? The answer is that, in fact, no complex reasoning is needed. Among the basic features of System 1 is its ability to set expectations and to be surprised when these expectations are violated. The system also retrieves possible causes of a surprise, usually by finding a possible cause among recent surprises. Furthermore, System 2 can reset the expectations of System 1 on the fly, so that an event that would normally be surprising is now almost normal. Suppose you are told that the 3-year-old boy who lives next door frequently wears a top hat in his stroller. You will be far less surprised when you actually see him with his top hat than you would have been without the warning. In Schwartz's experiment, the background music has been mentioned as a possible cause of retrieval problems. The difficulty of retrieving 12 instances is no longer a surprise, and therefore is less likely to be evoked by the task of judging assertiveness. Schwartz and his colleagues discovered that people who are personally involved in the judgment are more likely to consider the number of instances they retrieve from memory and less likely to go by fluency. They recruited 2 groups of students for a study of risks to cardiac health. Half the students had a family history of cardiac disease and were expected to take the task more seriously than the others, who had no such history. All were asked to recall either 3 or 8 behaviors in their routine that could affect their cardiac health. Some were asked for risky behaviors, others for protective behaviors. Students with no family history of heart disease were casual about the task and followed the availability heuristic. Students who found it difficult to find 8 instances of risky behavior felt themselves relatively safe. And those who struggled to retrieve examples of safe behaviors felt themselves at risk. The students with a family history of heart disease showed the opposite pattern. They felt safer when they retrieved many instances of safe behavior and felt greater danger when they retrieved many instances of risky behavior. They were also more likely to feel that their future behavior would be affected by the experience of evaluating their risk. The conclusion is that the ease with which instances come to mind is a System 1 heuristic, which is replaced by a focus on content when System 2 is more engaged. Multiple lines of evidence converge on the conclusion that people who let themselves be guided by System 1 are more strongly susceptible to availability biases than others who are in a state of higher vigilance. The following are some conditions in which people go with the flow and are affected more strongly by ease of retrieval than by the content they retrieved. When they are engaged in another effortful task at the same time. When they are in a good mood because they just thought of a happy episode in their life. If they score low on a depression scale. If they are knowledgeable novices on the topic of the task, in contrast to true experts. When they score high on a scale of faith in intuition. If they are, or are made to feel, powerful. I find the last finding particularly intriguing. The authors introduce their article with a famous quote. I don't spend a lot of time taking polls around the world to tell me what I think is the right way to act. I've just got to know how I feel. George W. Bush, November 2002. They go on to show that reliance on intuition is only in part a personality trait. Merely reminding people of a time when they had power increases their apparent trust in their own intuition. Speaking of availability. Because of the coincidence of two planes crashing last month, she now prefers to take the train. That's silly. The risk hasn't really changed. It is an availability bias. He underestimates the risks of indoor pollution because there are few media stories on them. That's an availability effect. He should look at the statistics. She has been watching too many spy movies recently, so she's seeing conspiracies everywhere. The CEO has had several successes in a row, so failure doesn't come easily to her mind. The availability bias is making her overconfident. Chapter 13. Availability, Emotion, and Risk. Students of risk were quick to see that the idea of availability was relevant to their concerns. Even before our work was published, The Economist, Howard Kunreuther, who was then in the early stages of a career that he has devoted to the study of risk and insurance, noticed that availability effects help explain the pattern of insurance purchase and protective action after disasters. Victims and near victims are very concerned after a disaster. After each significant earthquake, Californians are for a while diligent in purchasing insurance and adopting measures of protection and mitigation. They tie down their boiler to reduce quake damage, seal their basement doors against floods, and maintain emergency supplies in good order. However, the memories of the disaster dim over time, and so do worry and diligence. The dynamics of memory help explain the recurrent cycles of disaster, concern, and growing complacency that are familiar to students of large-scale emergencies. Kunreuther also observed that protective actions, whether by individuals or governments, are usually designed to be adequate to the worst disaster actually experienced. As long ago as Pharaonic Egypt, societies have tracked the high watermark of rivers that periodically flood and have always prepared accordingly, apparently assuming that floods will not rise higher than the existing high water mark. Images of a worse disaster do not come easily to mind. Availability and affect. The most influential studies of availability biases were carried out by our friends in Eugene, where Paul Slovic and his longtime collaborator Sarah Lichtenstein were joined by our former student, Baruch Fischoff. They carried out groundbreaking research on public perceptions of risks, including a survey that has become the standard example of an availability bias. They asked participants in their survey to consider pairs of causes of death, diabetes and asthma, or stroke and accidents. For each pair, the subjects indicated the more frequent cause and estimated the ratio of the two frequencies. The judgments were compared to health statistics of the time. Here's a sample of their findings. Strokes cause almost twice as many deaths as all accidents combined, but 80% of respondents judged accidental death to be more likely. Tornadoes were seen as more frequent killers than asthma, although the latter caused 20 times more deaths. Death by lightning was judged less likely than death from botulism, even though it is 52 times more frequent. Death by disease is 18 times as likely as accidental death, but the two were judged about equally likely. Death by accidents was judged to be more than 300 times more likely than death by diabetes, but the true ratio is 1 to 4. The lesson is clear. Estimates of causes of death are warped by media coverage. The coverage is itself biased toward novelty and poignancy. The media do not just shape what the public is interested in, but also are shaped by it. Editors cannot ignore the public's demand that certain topics and viewpoints receive extensive coverage. Unusual events, such as botulism, attract disproportionate attention and are consequently perceived as less unusual than they really are. The world in our heads is not a precise replica of reality. Our expectations about the frequency of events are distorted by the prevalence and emotional intensity of the messages to which we are exposed. The estimates of causes of death are an almost direct representation of the activation of ideas in associative memory and are a good example of substitution. But Slovic and his colleagues were led to a deeper insight. They saw that the ease with which ideas of various risks come to mind and the emotional reactions to these risks are inextricably linked. Frightening thoughts and images occur to us with particular ease, and thoughts of danger that are fluent and vivid exacerbate fear. As mentioned earlier, Slovic eventually developed the notion of an affect heuristic, in which people make judgments and decisions by consulting their emotions. Do I like it? Do I hate it? How strongly do I feel about it? In many domains of life, Slovic said, people form opinions and make choices that directly express their feelings and their basic tendency to approach or avoid, often without knowing that they are doing so. The affect heuristic is an instance of substitution, in which the answer to an easy question, how do I feel about it, serves as an answer to a much harder question, what do I think about it? Slovic and his colleagues related their views to the work of the neuroscientist Antonio Damasio, who had proposed that people's emotional evaluations of outcomes and the bodily states and the approach and avoidance tendencies associated with them all play a central role in guiding decision-making. Damasio and his colleagues have observed that people who do not display the appropriate emotions before they decide, sometimes because of brain damage, also have an impaired ability to make good decisions. An inability to be guided by a healthy fear of bad consequences is a disastrous flaw. In a compelling demonstration of the workings of the affect heuristic, Slovic's research team surveyed opinions about various technologies, including water fluoridation, chemical plants, food preservatives, and cars, and asked their respondents to list both the benefits and the risks of each technology. They observed an implausibly high negative correlation between two estimates that their respondents made, the level of benefit and the level of risk that they attributed to the technologies. When people were favorably disposed toward a technology, they rated it as offering large benefits and imposing little risk. When they disliked the technology, they could think only of its disadvantages and few advantages came to mind. Because the technologies lined up neatly from good to bad, no painful trade-offs needed to be faced. Estimates of risk and benefit corresponded even more closely when people rated risks and benefits under time pressure. Remarkably, members of the British Toxicology Society responded similarly. They found little benefit in substances or technologies that they thought risky, and vice versa. Consistent affect is a central element of what I have called associative coherence. The best part of the experiment came next. After completing the initial survey, the respondents read brief passages with arguments in favor of various technologies. Some were given arguments that focused on the numerous benefits of a technology, others, arguments that stressed the low risks. These messages were effective in changing the emotional appeal of the technologies. The striking finding was that people who had received a message extolling the benefits of a technology also changed their beliefs about its risks. Although they had received no relevant evidence, the technology they now liked more than before was also perceived as less risky. Similarly, respondents who were told only that the risks of a technology were mild developed a more favorable view of its benefits. The implication is clear. As the psychologist Jonathan Haidt said in another context, the emotional tail wags the rational dog. The affect heuristic simplifies our lives by creating a world that is much tidier than reality. Good technologies have few costs in the imaginary world we inhabit, bad technologies have no benefits, and all decisions are easy. In the real world, of course, we often face painful trade-offs between benefits and costs. The public and the experts. Paul Slovic probably knows more about the peculiarities of human judgment of risk than any other individual. His work offers a picture of Mr. and Ms. Citizen that is far from flattering, guided by emotion rather than by reason, easily swayed by trivial details, and inadequately sensitive to differences between low and negligibly low probabilities. Slovic has also studied experts, who are clearly superior in dealing with numbers and amounts. Experts show many of the same biases as the rest of us in attenuated form, but often their judgments and preferences about risks diverge from those of other people. Differences between experts and the public are explained in part by biases in lay judgments, but Slovic draws attention to situations in which the differences reflect a genuine conflict of values. He points out that experts often measure risks by the number of lives, or life years, lost, while the public draws finer distinctions, for example, between good deaths and bad deaths, or between random accidental fatalities and deaths that occur in the course of voluntary activities, such as skiing. These legitimate distinctions are often ignored in statistics that merely count cases. Slovic argues from such observations that the public has a richer conception of risks than the experts do. Consequently, he strongly resists the view that the experts should rule and that their opinions should be accepted without question when they conflict with the opinions and wishes of other citizens. When experts and the public disagree on their priorities, he says, each side must respect the insights and intelligence of the other. In his desire to wrest sole control of risk policy from experts, Slovic has challenged the foundation of their expertise, the idea that risk is objective. Risk does not exist out there, independent of our minds and culture waiting to be measured. Human beings have invented the concept of risk to help them understand and cope with the dangers and uncertainties of life. Although these dangers are real, there is no such thing as real risk or objective risk. To illustrate his claim, Slovic lists 9 ways of defining the mortality risk associated with the release of a toxic material into the air, ranging from death per million people to death per $1 million of product produced. His point is that The evaluation of the risk depends on the choice of a measure, with the obvious possibility that the choice may have been guided by a preference for one outcome or another. He goes on to conclude that defining risk is thus an exercise in power. You might not have guessed that one can get to such thorny policy issues from experimental studies of the psychology of judgment. However, policy is ultimately about people, what they want, and what is best for them. Every policy question involves assumptions about human nature, in particular about the choices that people may make and the consequences of their choices for themselves and for society. Another scholar and friend whom I greatly admire, Cass Sunstein, disagrees sharply with Slovic's stance on the different views of experts and citizens, and defends the role of experts as a bulwark against populist excesses. Sunstein is one of the foremost legal scholars in the United States, and shares with other leaders of his profession the attribute of intellectual fearlessness. He knows he can master any body of knowledge quickly and thoroughly, and he has mastered many, including both the psychology of judgment and choice, and issues of regulation and risk policy. His view is that the existing system of regulation in the United States displays a very poor setting of priorities, which reflects reaction to public pressures more than careful, objective analysis. He starts from the position that risk regulation and government intervention to reduce risks should be guided by rational weighting of costs and benefits, and that the natural units for this analysis are the number of lives saved, or perhaps the number of life years saved, which gives more weight to saving the young, and the dollar cost to the economy. Poor regulation is wasteful of lives and money, both of which can be measured objectively. Sunstein has not been persuaded by Slovic's argument that risk and its measurement is subjective. Many aspects of risk assessment are debatable, but he has faith in the objectivity that may be achieved by science, expertise, and careful deliberation. Sunstein came to believe that biased reactions to risks are an important source of erratic and misplaced priorities in public policy. Lawmakers and regulators may be overly responsive to the irrational concerns of citizens, both because of political sensitivity and because they are prone to the same cognitive biases as other citizens. Sunstein and a collaborator, the jurist Timur Kuran, invented a name for the mechanism through which biases flow into policy, the availability cascade. They comment that in the social context, all heuristics are equal, but availability is more equal than the others. They have in mind an expanded notion of the heuristic in which availability provides a heuristic for judgments other than frequency. In particular, the importance of an idea is often judged by the fluency and emotional charge with which that idea comes to mind. An availability cascade is a self-sustaining chain of events, which may start from media reports of a relatively minor event and lead up to public panic and large-scale government action. On some occasions, a media story about a risk catches the attention of a segment of the public, which becomes aroused and worried. This emotional reaction becomes a story in itself, prompting additional coverage in the media, which in turn produces greater concern and involvement. The cycle is sometimes sped along deliberately by availability entrepreneurs, individuals or organizations who work to ensure a continuous flow of worrying news. The danger is increasingly exaggerated as the media compete for attention-grabbing headlines. Scientists and others who try to dampen the increasing fear and revulsion attract little attention, most of it hostile. Anyone who claims that the danger is overstated is suspected of association with a heinous cover-up. The issue becomes politically important because it is on everyone's mind, and the response of the political system is guided by the intensity of public sentiment. The availability cascade has now reset priorities. Other risks and other ways that resources could be applied for the public good all have faded into the background. Curran and Sunstein focused on two examples that are still controversial: the Love Canal affair and the so-called ALAR scare. In Love Canal, buried toxic waste was exposed during a rainy season in 1979, causing contamination of the water well beyond standard limits, as well as a foul smell. The residents of the community were angry and frightened, and one of them, Lois Gibbs, was particularly active in an attempt to sustain interest in the problem. The availability cascade unfolded according to the standard script. At its peak, there were daily stories about Love Canal. Scientists attempting to claim that the dangers were overstated were ignored or shouted down. ABC News aired a program titled The Killing Ground, and empty baby-sized coffins were paraded in front of the legislature. A large number of residents were relocated at government expense, and the control of toxic waste became the major environmental issue of the 1980s. The legislation that mandated the cleanup of toxic sites, called CERCLA, CERCLA, established a superfund and is considered a significant achievement of environmental legislation. It was also expensive, and some have claimed that the same amount of money could have saved many more lives if it had been directed to other priorities. Opinions about what actually happened at Love Canal are still sharply divided, and claims of actual damage to health appear not to have been substantiated. Curran and Sunstein wrote up the Love Canal story almost as a pseudo-event, while on the other side of the debate, environmentalists still speak of the Love Canal disaster. Opinions are also divided on the second example Curran and Sunstein used to illustrate their concept of an availability cascade, the ALAR incident, known to detractors of environmental concerns as the ALAR scare of 1989. ALAR is a chemical that was sprayed on apples to regulate their growth and improve their appearance. The scare began with press stories that the chemical, when consumed in gigantic doses, caused cancerous tumors in rats and mice. The stories understandably frightened the public, and those fears encouraged more media coverage, the basic mechanism of an availability cascade. The topic dominated the news and produced dramatic media events such as the testimony of the actress Meryl Streep before Congress. The apple industry sustained large losses as apples and apple products became objects of fear. Curran and Sunstein quote a citizen who called in to ask whether it was safer to pour apple juice down the drain or to take it to a toxic waste dump. The manufacturer withdrew the product, and the FDA banned it. Subsequent research confirmed that the substance might pose a very small risk as a possible carcinogen, but the ALAR incident was certainly an enormous overreaction to a minor problem. The net effect of the incident on public health was probably detrimental because fewer good apples were consumed. The ALAR tale illustrates a basic limitation in the ability of our mind to deal with small risks. We either ignore them altogether or give them far too much weight. Nothing in between. Every parent who has stayed up waiting for a teenage daughter who is late from a party will recognize the feeling. You may know that there is really almost nothing to worry about, but you cannot help images of disaster from coming to mind. As Slovic has argued, the amount of concern is not adequately sensitive to the probability of harm. You are imagining the numerator, the tragic story you saw on the news, and not thinking about the denominator. Sunstein has coined the phrase probability neglect to describe the pattern. The combination of probability neglect with the social mechanisms of availability cascades inevitably leads to gross exaggerations of minor threats, sometimes with important consequences. In today's world, terrorists are the most significant practitioners of the art of inducing availability cascades. With a few horrible exceptions, such as 9/11, the number of casualties from terror attacks is very small relative to other causes of death. Even in countries that have been targets of intensive terror campaigns, such as Israel, the weekly number of casualties almost never came close to the number of traffic deaths. The difference is in the availability of the two risks, the ease and the frequency with which they come to mind. Gruesome images, endlessly repeated in the media, cause everyone to be on edge. As I know from experience, it is difficult to reason oneself into a state of complete calm. Terrorism speaks directly to System 1. Where do I come down in the debate between my friends? Availability cascades are real, and they undoubtedly distort priorities in the allocation of public resources. Cass Sunstein would seek mechanisms that insulate decision-makers from public pressures, letting the allocation of resources be determined by impartial experts who have a broad view of all risks and of the resources available to reduce them. Paul Slovic trusts the experts much less, and the public somewhat more than Sunstein does, and he points out that insulating the experts from the emotions of the public produces policies that the public will reject, an impossible situation in a democracy. Both are eminently sensible, and I agree with both. I share Sunstein's discomfort with the influence of irrational fears and availability cascades on public policy in the domain of risk. However, I also share Slovic's belief that widespread fears, even if they are unreasonable, should not be ignored by policymakers. Rational or not, fear is painful and debilitating, and policymakers must endeavor to protect the public from fear, not only from real dangers. Slovic rightly stresses the resistance of the public to the idea of decisions being made by unelected and unaccountable experts. Furthermore, availability cascades may have a long-term benefit by calling attention to classes of risks and by increasing the overall size of the risk reduction budget. The Love Canal incident may have caused excessive resources to be allocated to the management of toxic waste, but it also had a more general effect in raising the priority level of environmental concerns. Democracy is inevitably messy, in part because the availability and affect heuristics that guide citizens' beliefs and attitudes are inevitably biased, even if they generally point in the right direction. Psychology should inform the design of risk policies that combine the expert's knowledge with the public's emotions and intuitions. Speaking of availability cascades, she's raving about an innovation that has large benefits and no costs. I suspect the affect heuristic. This is an availability cascade, a non-event that is inflated by the media and the public until it fills our TV screens and becomes all anyone is talking about. Chapter 14. Tom W.'s Specialty. Have a look at a simple puzzle. Tom W. is a graduate student at the main university in your state. Please rank the following 9 fields of graduate specialization in order of the likelihood that Tom W. is now a student in each of these fields. Use 1 for the most likely, 9 for the least likely. Business Administration. computer science, engineering, humanities and education, law, medicine, library science, physical and life sciences, social science and social work. This question is easy, and you knew immediately that the relative size of enrollment in the different fields is the key to a solution. So far as you know, Tom W. was picked at random from the graduate students at the university, like a single marble drawn from an urn. To decide whether a marble is more likely to be red or green, you need to know how many marbles of each color there are in the urn. The proportion of marbles of a particular kind is called a base rate. Similarly, the base rate of humanities and education in this problem is the proportion of students of that field among all the graduate students. In the absence of specific information about Tom W., you will go by the base rates and guess that he is more likely to be enrolled in humanities and education than in computer science or library science, because there are more students overall in humanities and education than in the other two fields. Using base rate information is the obvious move when no other information is provided. Next comes a task that has nothing to do with base rates. The following is a personality sketch of Tom W., written during Tom's senior year in high school by a psychologist on the basis of psychological tests of uncertain validity. Tom W. is of high intelligence, although lacking in true creativity. He has a need for order and clarity and for neat and tidy systems in which every detail finds its appropriate place. His writing is rather dull and mechanical, occasionally enlivened by somewhat corny puns and flashes of imagination of the sci-fi type. He has a strong drive for competence. He seems to have little feel and little sympathy for other people, and does not enjoy interacting with others. Self-centered, he nonetheless has a deep moral sense. Now, please take a sheet of paper and rank the 9 fields of specialization listed by how similar the description of Tom W. is to the typical graduate student in each of the following fields. Use 1 for the most likely and 9 for the least likely. You will get more out of the chapter if you give the task a quick try. Reading the report on Tom W. is necessary to make your judgments about the various graduate specialties. This question, too, is straightforward. It requires you to retrieve, or perhaps to construct, a stereotype of graduate students in the different fields. When the experiment was first conducted in the early 1970s, the average ordering was as follows. Yours is probably not very different. 1. Computer science. 2. Engineering. 3. Business administration. 4. Physical and life sciences. 5. Library science. 6. Law. 7. Medicine. 8. Humanities and education. 9. Social science and social work. You probably ranked computer science among the best fitting because of hints of nerdiness, corny puns. In fact, the description of Tom W. was written to fit that stereotype. Another specialty that most people ranked high is engineering, neat and tidy systems. You probably thought that Tom W. is not a good fit with your idea of social science and social work, little feel and little sympathy for other people. Professional stereotypes appear to have changed little in the nearly 40 years since I designed the description of Tom W. The task of ranking the 9 careers is complex and certainly requires the discipline and sequential organization of which only System 2 is capable. However, the hints planted in the description, corny puns and others, were intended to activate an association with a stereotype, an automatic activity of System 1. The instructions for this similarity task required a comparison of the description of Tom W. to the stereotypes of the various fields of specialization. For the purposes of that task, the accuracy of the description, whether or not it is a true portrait of Tom W., is irrelevant. So is your knowledge of the basic